work that Diego Córdoba and I have done about a year ago, and then also some more recent work by Diego Córdoba, Antonio Córdoba, Marco Fontalos, and me. So I'm the token non-Spaniard. Let me write the names down. So this is about the material of the title, two-dimensional sharp fronts. And then the more recent work is about the breakup of drops. And that's again with Córdoba, Antonio Córdoba, and Marco Fontalos. Okay. Now, the problems that I want to talk about are of interest because they're closely related to the problem of singularities or versus global existence of the Euler and Navier-Stokes equations. These are, of course, classic equations, very, very hard. Nobody knows anything significant about them, neither do I. On the other hand, I'm supposed to fill up an hour. Now, Diego and I have discovered something very simple. It will take 5 minutes to explain. Nevertheless, people seem to have not noticed it before, and it seems to be useful for some problems. On the other hand, it takes about 5 minutes to explain, and I'm supposed to fill up about an hour. So what I will do is place it in context by explaining to you a lot of stuff that you already know. I will keep doing that until there are about 10 minutes left, and then I'll explain the new stuff. Okay. All right. Fine. So let's start with the Euler equation in 2D and 3D. All right. So we're in RD cross R2, and D is 2 or 3. All right. Our unknowns are a velocity, u of xt, and a pressure, p of xt. This is scalar valued. This is a velocity, so it takes its values in Rd. And here, x is in Rd, and t is a time, so it's in R. Okay? Now, I'm sorry? At the top? Where am I? Oh, dear. Sorry. Wrong already. All right. So remember, the Euler equation, which is supposed to describe an ideal, frictionless, incompressible fluid, is this equation. Let's say this will exist up to time t, and we wonder how big capital T is, okay? With the extra condition that u is divergence-free, and there's an initial condition, u of x0 is some given u0 of x. This thing is given, smooth, divergence-free, let's say rapidly decreasing at infinity. Okay, so that's the Euler equation. Okay? Now, local existence is no problem. Okay? So, local existence, given u0 as above, okay? There exists T positive, depending on u0, maybe depending on u0, such that the Euler equation in dimensions V equals 2 or 3 has a unique, smooth solution over there. Physically reasonable in the sense that it's rapidly enough decreasing. So, all right, let me try to speak English. Decreasing rapidly enough as x goes to infinity, uniformly in t. Let me not be precise. This talk will be very imprecise. The purpose of the first 55 minutes is to burn up time. Okay. So that's no problem. The interesting question is how large can you take t, and is it necessary to take t finite depending on the data? So the big question, which no one can answer, well, a big question which no one can answer, is can one take capital T equals infinity? Or is there instead some finite capital T which represents the largest possible that you can take in such a way that the that, let's say, for that value of T there is a solution and it's smooth? Notice I described a half open interval in time, and the question is what happens as time approaches capital T, a singularity develops so that one cannot continue a smooth solution of the Euler equation past that. Nobody knows. I don't either. The work that I'm going to describe is directed at this question. Okay. Let me say a few words about what everybody knows about the Euler equation. Presumably Euler knew this about the Euler equation. And then maybe I will complain to you a little about why the problem is hard and tell you about partial results. So the plan is that after I do that, then I would like to describe a particular model problem. The model problem is the quasi-geostrophic equation. QG. This is a two-dimensional equation. This is a two-dimensional equation, which, however, bears interest in that it is closely related to the three-dimensional case of this big question. I should say, d equals 2. The answer is yes. You can take t equals infinity, global existence, no problem. I've been criticized for saying such things. These theorems were big when first proved, but nowadays we've had time to chew on them and they're well understood. D equals 3 is the big question. So there's an important effect which everybody in fluid dynamics knows about, which causes the three-dimensional case to be much harder than the two-dimensional case. It's the amplification of vorticity. That's the problem. That doesn't take place in two dimensions, and this quasi-geostrophic equation has the property that, on the one hand, it's a two-dimensional equation, and on the other hand, unlike 2D Euler, it does exhibit amplification of vorticity, so that this is an excellent model, an excellent two-dimensional model for the three-dimensional Euler equation. Let's see, this equation, which I'll eventually write down, was proposed, I think, as early as the 40s as a model for weather prediction. It didn't do very well for that and was gathered dust until in the 90s, Constantine, Maida, and Tabak discovered that this equation was a useful model of 3D Euler, and did interesting theoretical and numerical studies. All right, we'll get back to this. Before I went off on that, I wanted to tell you what Euler knew about the Euler equations. Well, for one thing, there's no dissipation, so energy is conserved. Energy being That's a trivial integration by parts. Okay, energy is conserved. That's nice. Of course, the flow is incompressible. That's part of the problem. Right. There's the second line up there, incompressible flow. But the most interesting formal property of the 3D Euler equation is that vorticity moves with the fluid. Let me explain what that means. By the way, in calculating how much time to fill up, I should know when the lecture is supposed to end. When is the lecture supposed to end?
Round two.
Round two, okay. Okay. Not a sharp front. Okay. All right. So let me explain what it means that vorticity moves with the fluid. So let me distinguish between two dimensions and three dimensions. So let's say in two dimensions, all right, we have our, for a fixed time, we have u of x t, and that's a vector field in the plane. So its curl, which I'm going to call omega, all right, this is a scalar. So it's simply a function on, it's simply a function of x and t, okay? Now, this moves with the fluid in the sense that if you take a molecule at position x and time zero, and you let it move with the fluid so that, let's say, dx, all right, so you're given, let's say, x of zero, and let's say dx of t by dt is equal to u of t x of t, okay, so that means that x of t is the position of a molecule in the fluid, okay, that if this is true, then if you look at omega, the vorticity, at time t, at the position of the given molecule, this is independent of t. That's a simple formal consequence of the Euler equation, okay? So the vorticity moves with the fluid. That immediately means that the vorticity cannot grow. Various things can happen to it, but if the vorticity is not very big, it's not going to, I mean, if initially the vorticity is not very big, it can never get any bigger. Boundary conditions are, of course, very interesting, but they also make the problem even harder. So I'm assuming that we're in free space and that things go to zero at spatial infinity fast enough that I can ignore boundary effects.
So there's no obstacle.
Exactly. I'll be talking a little about computer simulations where, of course, space is finite and one takes a flat torus. But right, boundaries are very interesting. They introduce yet other problems, and even these are hard, so... No boundaries, no obstacles. Okay. All right, so that's what it means that in two dimensions when I say that vorticity moves with the fluid. Okay? In three dimensions. All right. Let's let omega of xt be the curl x of the vorticity. So, of course, that's a vector field. For each fixed time, there's a vector field. And then that vector field moves with the fluid. All right, in what sense? Well, all right, let me not say this in the sharpest possible way, but for instance, let's think of a line of vorticity. All right, so a vortex line. And that's simply an integral curve of the vorticity for fixed t. Okay, so here's a line of vorticity, and so think of a tornado. So the velocity is doing something like that going around the axis, and the vorticity is doing something like this, and we look at one line of vorticity. Now, that line of vorticity should be behaves as if it were a material thing. So that is, take, for example, two points at time zero, and imagine that these two points lie in common on a line of vorticity. All right? Then imagine that each of them moves with the fluid, and they both stop at the same time. Then these two points will still lie on the same line of vorticity. So that, in fact, if one took all the molecules on a given line of vorticity at time zero, and then let all of these molecules together flow with the, move with the fluid and stop at time t, then those molecules would fill up a line of vorticity for the fluid flow at time t. That's the most interesting known formal property of the Euler equations, and I would bet that this was known to Euler. Okay? So in that sense, vorticity moves with the fluid. Okay, so these are the basic properties of the Euler equations. Okay. Now to go a little further, for that matter, to see this fact, a good thing to do is to take the curl of the Euler equations. That does two good things. First of all, it gets rid of the gradient of the pressure, and secondly, it brings in the vorticity, which is that's the good thing to study. And so, if you simply take the curl of both sides of the equation, then you get the following version of the Euler equation, which is completely equivalent to the thing as first written. So first, if d equals 2, you have partial t plus u dot grad x applied to omega equals 0, where remember omega is a scalar, okay? And when d equals 3, you have dt plus u dot grad x of omega equals up to a sign, I don't remember, grad u, acting on omega. U is a vector, grad u is a matrix. You let that matrix act on a vector. Wait a minute, which way do you take the matrix? Fortunately, it doesn't matter. Anyway, so this thing is a singular integral operator acting on omega. U, in either case, u arises from omega simply because you find u from omega by solving curl u equals omega, divergence of u equals 0. So u arises from omega by the Biot-Savart law. Formally, to get from omega to u, you integrate once, and therefore to get from omega to the gradient of u, you're formally integrating 0 times. You apply a singular integral operator, k, which one can easily write down explicitly, and which, morally speaking, is not so different from the identity operator. Okay? Now, immediately, this shows you that the two-dimensional Euler equation is likely to be okay, and the three-dimensional Euler equation is less likely to be okay, because this is some glorified version of the equation d omega by dt is equal to 0, which we would know how to handle, and this is some glorified version of the equation d omega by dt equals omega squared, which is considerably more dangerous and considerably more likely to blow up in finite time. Okay? All right. Fine. So there's the vorticity form of the equation. Okay, by which I mean that. Okay. So now let me moan and whine in lieu of proving anything for a few minutes. All right, so why is this problem, why is this equation difficult to understand? Well, how could one try to understand it? We're mathematicians. We could try to prove theorems, okay? But, all right, at the same time, we live in the age of the computer, and so one could try to give a numerical simulation and understand how the Euler equation behaves that way. And finally, the Euler equation is supposed to have something to do with fluids, and so one could make physical experiments and try to understand how physical fluids behave and see if that tells us anything about the Euler equation. And so what I'd like to do is give you just a two-minute sketch about each of these methods and explain why in fact, so far, the insight gained from all these three avenues is far from sufficient. Okay, so first of all, let's say a physical experiment. There are practical limitations on the experiments, and there are fundamental limitations on the experiments. Here's an example of a practical limitation on an experiment. So you put a fluid in a tank. Well, all right, there is a boundary to the tank. That's one problem. But all right, how do you know what the fluid is doing? Well, you insert a little probe. Now the little probe disturbs the fluid. Is the effect on the fluid significant or insignificant? Well, if the probe is very small and unobtrusive, then probably the effect is negligible except near the probe, which is unfortunately the only place where you're allowed to measure what's going on. So this is an actual consideration which has which has invalidated experiments by some of the best people. It's not that they're too dumb to understand. They're just as smart as anybody else. But they were aware. I'm thinking of particular people in particular experiments. Experimenters are well aware that these dangers exist. They go ahead and do their experiments, and then afterwards it can take years to check. All right, make the probes, let's say, half as big or twice as big. Does that make a significant difference in the experiments? And the answer is yes. So that's one example of a practical difficulty, and there are others. It's very, very difficult to do these. At the same time, technology is getting better all the time. yes, there's also a fundamental difference, fundamental problem, which is connected with the reason why one is interested in the Euler equations. In the Euler equations study an idealized fluid with zero viscosity. A real fluid does not have zero viscosity. It may have very small viscosity. You could argue that that a real fluid with very small viscosity behaves very much like a fluid with zero viscosity, but it turns out that isn't true. Fluids with very, very, very small viscosities behave completely differently from fluids with zero viscosity. I don't have time to get into that. I think a lot of you already know that. So you could argue, why study the Euler equations? But in fact, if you want to understand what's going on for very, very small viscosities, a significant part of the story may well be that the Euler equations break down. All right. In any event, that's an indication that physical experiment is unlikely to be a quick and easy road to correct guesses. Numerical simulation. Computers may be big and powerful, but they're finite. What you're doing is taking, when you implement any numerical method, however clever, you're taking a function which is inherently an infinite dimensional thing and replacing it by a finite number, representing it by a finite number of bits. So the best you can do is represent it at a finite number of places or a finite number of modes or whatever to finite accuracy. Now, with any luck, your function is sort of smooth or sort of well-behaved, or you understand something about it, and therefore, with a finite number of bits, you can specify pretty well what it's doing. Unfortunately, as you approach a singularity, you stop believing that. And so precisely as your computer simulation starts to show you something interesting, that's where you no longer believe what your computer is telling you. One could overcome this if one had some theoretical understanding of what the singularity looks like, and then you can try to desingularize the problem one way or the other, but unfortunately there is no such, no one has such good understanding for the Euler equations. What you do see when you make numerical simulations is that there are a lot of simulations in which the U0, let's say, is initially very nice, but after a finite time, it looks like a big mess. If you were looking at a picture of what the computer is telling you and you had to describe to your friend on the telephone what's going on, you would be on the phone for a long time and your friend really wouldn't know what you're describing. So, yes. So the solutions appear to be a big mess. It appears as if a singularity may be maybe developing, one doesn't know whether there's really a singularity, and if so, if there is one, one doesn't really know what it looks like. Okay. And so if you look at the non-rigorous fluids literature, it's full of alleged singular solutions of the Euler equations obtained by numerical simulations with pictures or movies. Some of these have been disproven, and others twist slowly, slowly in the wind. Okay. And now finally, if you want to prove theorems, this problem is nonlinear, non-local, and supercritical. That is to say, people in PDEs have a collection of very clever, useful tricks, but they don't seem to apply to this equation. Maybe the day after tomorrow, some very clever person will discover some clever little twist so that, in fact, it was all obvious all along. But one is not inclined to bet that way. It just looks very hard and well, all right. All right. Enough complaining. Oh, please. That vortices will blow. I mean that stretch and bend. Yes. Okay. So now I want to tell you theorems in that direction. Okay. So the progress isn't quite zero. Now I don't want to oversell the progress. I think the theorems that I'm about to talk about are interesting and useful, but they're many orders of magnitude away from understanding the Euler equations. All right. The theorems that I want to describe have the nature of, suppose the Euler equations break down in finite time, what would the singularity look like? Okay, and let me tell you two theorems and try to justify them a little bit. Let's see, let's erase the equation. All right, so the classic thing in this theorem in this genre is the Biot-Kato-Mida theorem, which says if a singularity forms at time t, that is, t is finite and up to time t, but not including time t, there's a smooth solution, but it cannot be continued any further than t. Okay, if the singularity forms at time t, then the integral from time 0 to time t of the maximum vorticity, so the sup over x of omega of xt dt, is infinite. Okay? That means that if a singularity forms, it can only form by the blow-up of vorticity. So thank you for the friendly question. I think you knew this theorem. Okay, the omega has to get real big real fast. Before this theorem came out, there was this, for a, all right, it had been true for a long time that there have been a lot of alleged singular solutions of Euler. When this theorem first came out, one could then immediately look in the literature at the alleged singular solutions of Euler and look at this. And this is, I mean, this is a quantity of which applied and numerical people keep very close track. And one could see that for most of the alleged singular solutions, there was no evidence that this was blowing up at all. And so one takes those alleged solutions and throws them in the trash can and declares that they're numerical artifacts. All right. I think the biggest single use of this is that it's a solution buster. Okay. All right. So the second theorem is due to Constantine and your humble servant and Mida, and says that if a singularity forms at time t, then the direction of vorticity, let's call it C of x. All right, it depends also on t. which is omega divided by absolute omega, this direction of vorticity, okay, cannot be lip 1 as a function of x uniformly in t up to the blow up. Okay, so this suggests that there have to be tubes of intense vorticity, and those tubes had better bend or something, or one tube had better be very close to another tube going in a very different direction. Something geometrically strange has to happen. All right, now I've succeeded brilliantly in wasting a lot of time, so let me now come to the QG equation. I'd like to state it, and I'd like to explain what a wonderful model it is. I will state the equation. I will show you that, or I'll say all of this stuff holds for the QG equation as well as for the 3D Euler equation. Okay, so that it forms a good model. Yet it is two-dimensional, therefore it's easy to, it is not as horrible to simulate on a computer as 3D Euler. But there's another crucial advantage, and the crucial advantage is this. Unlike 3D Euler, there is a particular scenario that comes out from numerical studies which may or may not, which looks temptingly like a singular solution. So for the QG equation, a singular scenario will stare us in the face. And the question will not be, is there some big mess which leads to a singularity, but does a particular thing happen which one can easily describe to one's friend on the telephone, and does a singularity occur that way? And then what Diego and I discovered is very strong evidence that the answer is no, it doesn't form that way. All right, so what is the QG equation? So we're in two dimensions as advertised, and then there's time, right? And there is a velocity field. It's incompressible, so it arises as the perpendicular gradient of a stream function. Like that. Okay. So this is nothing. This is just elementary potential theory. Any incompressible velocity is the gradient perpendicular of a stream function. Okay. There is a temperature. So there is a scalar theta of xt, and the scalar is convected along by the fluid, so that. So this thing is convected along by the fluid, so all right. But furthermore, the theta determines the u and determines the stream function. And the way we'll do this, and so this is what makes it QG, is that one decides that the stream function is going to be set equal to the Laplacian to the minus half power of theta for each fixed time. So I hope this is a familiar object. If this is not a familiar object, just think that we're on the torus and we expand everything in a Fourier series. And to apply the Laplacian is to multiply by the absolute value of k squared, and to apply of the Laplacian to the minus a half power is simply to divide by the first power of absolute k. This leaves open the constant term set at equal to zero. Okay. So theta determines psi, which determines u. So for each fixed t, Theta Psi and U are on the, I mean, they're the same thing, different ways of expressing the same thing, and this is an equation for how that thing evolves. Okay? The analog of this thing, the analog for this thing of the vorticity is the gradient perpendicular of theta. That's the analog of the vorticity. Now, let's look at all this. The energy is conserved. The integral of theta squared is conserved. That's trivial because theta is carried along by an incompressible fluid. It is an incompressible fluid because U is the gradient perpendicular of the stream function. Vorticity moves with the fluid. That means that integral curves of the gradient perpendicular of theta move with the fluid. That means level curves of theta move with the fluid. Yep, theta is convected by the fluid. Level curves of theta are convected by the fluid. No problem. All right. There is a vorticity form of the equation, and it takes the form that dt plus u dot gradient x of gradient perpendicular of theta is equal to gradient perpendicular theta times some singular integral acting on gradient perpendicular theta. So it has the same, formally it's on the same footing as the 3D Euler equation, whereas remember for the 2D Euler equation, we should have seen a zero here. So this thing is two-dimensional, but it's more singular than 2D Euler. If here instead of a Laplacian to the minus a half, you just had 1 over the Laplacian, you would get 2D Euler. Okay, so this is worse than 2D Euler. And furthermore, if in place of omega you use this quantity, then there are analogs of the Biel-Kato-Mida theorem and the this theorem on the direction of vorticity. Okay, so that sets this thing up as a model of 3D Euler. But now, all right, so what I've just described to you is in the paper of Konstantin Mida Tabak, and now the question that I want to pose is whether the QG equation leads to a breakdown. If you take a nice, smooth initial theta and then solve as time goes forward by the QG equation, do you get a singularity? And the answer is maybe, and here are the pictures to back that up. All right. So here's the first picture, and this is, let's say, t equals zero, and it turns out that the interesting behavior happens at a hyperbolic fixed point. Hyperbolic saddle. So suppose that theta, this function theta, the temperature, has a critical point of indefinite sign, so that the level curves of theta look like this. All right. Now let's let time move forward a little. Let's say t is 1. Needless to say, I didn't bring fancy computer-generated pictures, and I don't remember what t really is or exactly what the initial conditions look like. But what happens is that these two lines, let me call these two lines the arms of the saddle, okay? They start to look like that, and the other level curves do this kind of thing. And then let's say at time t equals 1.5, you see a picture something like this. Whoop. Nope. Okay. So depending on where you're sitting, maybe you see and maybe you don't quite see that these curves are not quite the same, and these guys have moved over here and these guys are doing that. And perhaps at t equals 1.6, what's happening is that the two lines, the two arms of the saddle have simply closed up and formed one single line, which would be a singularity in the equation. So the question, one could then put a more concrete version of the question of breakdown. The analog of the big question for 3D Euler here would be Initially smooth solutions of QG become singular in finite time? The easier version of the question is, look at this singularity. Look at this alleged singularity. Take these initial conditions. Does the angle between these two arms, do these two curves coincide in finite time, yes or no?
Why is that a singularity? I mean, doesn't it just form a sort of crest? What's one singular?
Let me see. All right. Let me convince you that without answering your question, let me convince you that something must be singular. Okay, if you could continue the solution further, and everything were smooth, then you would have a diffeomorphism which takes time zero position to time t position. But at this particular time, here are two distinct points that go to the same point. So it isn't a diffeomorphism anymore. So whatever is becoming singular, something must be. Okay. And I've done a good enough job wasting time that I should keep going. Okay. All right. So question, does this happen? All right. Now, it is natural to look at this question in the light of the analog of the Biel-Kato-Maeda theorem and the theorem on the direction field. As far as the direction field is concerned, notice what's going on. These directions are shifting very dramatically. The thing is look at this guy. It's pointing this way, and then all of a sudden it points that way. So it's changing very sharply. So this is consistent with the way a singularity is supposed to look. That's always encouraging. How about Biel-Kato-Maeda? All right, what is the maximum of the gradient of theta, the maximum size of the gradient of theta for fixed t, and how does that vary with t as t approaches the singularity? I'm aware of three studies of this question, the original one by Konstantin Maeda-Tabak, a later one by Okitani and Yamada, and a most recent one by Konstantin Ni and Soghover. And I'm going to misspell the names if I try to write them down. All right. The initial study suggested that, in fact, the maximum of the gradient, the thing that's the analog of the gradient of, the thing that's analogous to the maximum of omega, in fact, does blow up and looks like 1 over a power of the time to the alleged breakdown, that power being strictly greater than 1. I don't remember what it is. This is done by fitting a curve. This is all numerical and what it gives one an uneasy feeling to believe too much that. Okay. All right. The study of Okitani and Yamada, starting with the same initial conditions, suggested that, in fact, there is no singularity, and the maximum of what's analogous to the vorticity grows like e to the e to the t as a function of t. And so one could be forgiven for thinking that that blows up in finite time, but in fact, if you look with a bigger computer and you become convinced that it looks like that, but one has the uneasy feeling of not necessarily believing it. And then the Konstantin Ni and Soghover result is, I think, again with the same initial condition, is that indeed things blow up like e to the e to the t for a while, but then they stop blowing up further after a while. So those are the numerical results. Diego and I think other people too, thought hard about this question for a long time. We don't have rigorous results on whether this did happen, but finally, we arrived at the following trivial thing. So now, can I have, let's say, until 2:05? Okay. All right, so I would like to show you a little remark which seems to be quite useful. We discovered it in connection with QG, but in fact it has nothing to do with QG. It's a general remark about 2D fluids and can therefore be applied also to 2D magnetohydrodynamics, about which I know nothing, but Diego assures me that, I won't go into what Diego assures me. This is a general. This has much more general applicability than QG. It just happened to come out of QG. All right, so suppose that we have U of XT, an incompressible fluid. So here's the new stuff. Fluid in the plane. So this is a velocity, it's divergence free. Okay? Fine. Now, we have two, all right, let's not look at it everywhere, let's only look at it on a little rectangle. And in this little rectangle, let's imagine that we have two curves, gamma 1 and let's say gamma 0. For each time, think of these as being the arms of a saddle. These are going to move with the fluid. So these are curves that move with the fluid. In the sense that if you put a dot on this curve at time t0 and then let that dot move with the fluid, let it solve an ODE, x dot equals u of xt, then at later times the dot will continue to be on the corresponding curve. Okay? So that's what I mean, curves that move with the fluid. The way I'm going to be thinking here is that I will fix my rectangle over here. This appears to be the tough part of the world where the singularity is happening, but I'm not even going to look there. I'm going to look here. And so the two arms of the saddle are my curves. Okay? So they're curves that move with the fluid, and I'm going to imagine, just as in this picture, that gamma 1 lies above gamma 2. Okay? In this picture, I'm going to say that a sharp front forms. That's the definition. In this case, a sharp front forms at time t if, all right, so let's say this, each of these are graphs. All right, gamma I is x2 equals c sub I of x1 t. Okay, that's the x2 axis, that's the x1 axis. Okay? And what I'm going to say is that the limit as little t goes to capital T from below of the vertical distance between the curves, so psi 1 of xt minus x1t minus psi 0 of x1t, this is 0. 0. Okay? So the curves collapse together into a single curve. As little t approaches capital T, these two curves approach a single curve, a single limiting curve. I'm going to call that a sharp front. That's what's alleged to happen for the QG equation. It's also what's alleged to happen in 2D magnetohydrodynamics and elsewhere. Okay? Now, the little trivial remark that nobody seems to have noticed and that rules out these scenarios is, or appears to rule out these scenarios, is that, so, remark, if a sharp front forms at time t, then the integral from 0 to t of the max of the spatial max of the velocity, not the vorticity, but the velocity, diverges. Okay, let's compare this for a second with Biel-Kato-Maeda. Biel-Kato-Maeda talk about an arbitrary singularity for a particular equation. What we're talking about here is a particular kind of singularity, a sharp front, with no equation, just an arbitrary incompressible fluid. Okay. That has an actual proof. This is a little remark with a three-line proof that I'll show you. But the interest of this is that particular scenarios that people were wondering about are of this form. And therefore, this little remark is a useful little remark in that it tells us what to believe. All right. Let me just say that although it's a delicate question whether the sup of omega is blowing up as a function of t, and depending on whose simulation you look at, you don't know what to believe. Nobody produces the slightest scintilla of evidence that this thing is growing at all at the alleged breakdown. You just look at what the velocity is supposed to do, and it appears just to be staying of a constant order of magnitude, not growing at all. So the evidence in favor of the singularity has collapsed, although, of course, well, one doesn't know. It's still, you know, conceivably this is true, but just hasn't been caught by the numerics. Oh, all right. So, for a sharp front to form and for this theorem to apply, it's that the two arcs completely collapse at one time into one arc. And so how about the question of pinching at one point? Well, we're working on that, but we don't have any results on that. Okay. All right. Let me explain the proof, okay? Can I have 2 more minutes to explain the proof? I'm going to explain it in the nice way suggested by Rafael de la Llave. All right. So, what I'm going to do is form a trap. Here are our two arcs, gamma 1 of t, gamma 0 of t. Now my trap is going to have these two, so to speak, horizontal sides and two vertical sides. The vertical sides are just vertical straight lines. And I imagine that they are rushing outward. And the speed at which they are rushing outward is the maximum of the velocity, of the fluid velocity, over the rectangle for the given time. That's how fast these guys are rushing apart. So I set them at some initial position, and then I let them rush outward with the maximum speed for the trap, with the maximum speed of the fluid. Okay? Notice that if I set this trap at a time just slightly before capital T, and if I assume that the, let me assume by contradiction, by way of contradiction, let's assume that that's finite. So if you assume that this is finite, then you can make it small by taking here t minus delta. Okay? So you take delta sufficiently small, you then set the trap, and you discover that as these things move outward, this trap does not leave the rectangle. This wall does not leave the rectangle. If it left the rectangle, you'd be in trouble because you have no assumption at all about what the fluid is doing. Now, think about this trap, okay? So the trap has been set. This trap eats fluid molecules, but fluid molecules never escape from the trap. How could a fluid molecule escape from the trap? It can't get out through this wall because this wall moves with the fluid. Can't get out through that wall similarly. It can't get out through that wall because this wall is moving this way faster than a particle here trying to escape. So fluid molecules can never escape from the trap. They can only be eaten by the trap. These walls never eat any molecules because they move with the fluid, but these walls overtake fluid molecules, and so fluid molecules are being eaten by the trap but never escape. This is an area-preserving flow, so one checks easily that the area of the trap must increase as a function of time. But if this wall and this wall close, then the area of the trap reaches zero in finite time, so it can't happen. That's the proof. There are fancier versions of this, and again, I didn't get to droplets. I was too efficient in wasting time. That's the result. And the net effect is that by this very, very, very simple remark, one looks at scenarios for several different fluid equations where it wasn't quite clear what to believe, and all of the evidence on one side has collapsed, even though the questions are not rigorously decided. All right, thank you.